Rebellion. To join one near you, go to unitedforthepeople.org. That's United, the number four, thepeople.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio KC. I'm Natural Lee. Tonight, Craig Lubo will interview Kim Lovell, the chair of the National Population Committee of the Sierra Club. They will discuss population and sustainability. The second guest on our show tonight is Ricky Ott. She is a marine toxicologist and will talk about oil spills. But first, I have your news headlines. A U.S. Geological Survey study showed that alkalinity, a measurement of a river's capacity to neutralize acid inputs, has increased over the past 65 years in 14 of the 23 rivers assessed in the United States. Reduced acidity levels were especially common in rivers in the Northeast, such as the Delaware and the Schuylkill Rivers, and in the Midwest, such as the Illinois and Ohio Rivers and the Missouri River and the Great Plains. By looking at changes in multiple chemicals, scientists conducted the study found that the alkalinity increases were due to decreasing acidic inputs. The reason for decreased acidic inputs have been diverse and include greater regulation of industrial emissions and waste treatment and increased use of agricultural lime. Quote, the study shows that our cumulative management actions over the last half century have reduced acidity levels in the United States rivers, end quote, says lead author Edward Stetz, research ecologist at the USGS. Quote, acidification of rivers that empty into estuaries can adversely impact shell-bearing organisms such as oysters and crabs, end quote. The University of Dayton announced that it would divest its $670 million investment pool to fossil fuel companies. Monday's announcement made Dayton the first Catholic university to make such a decision. The divestment will take place in phases, beginning with the removal of holdings from its domestic equity accounts. Next, the university will develop plans to eliminate fossil fuels from its international holdings to coincide with investments in green and sustainable technologies or holdings. The university will also restrict future investments in private equity or hedge funds whose investments support fossil fuel or significant carbon-producing holdings. Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org, is thankful for the timing of the university's announcement given Pope Francis's recent declaration that, quote, if we destroy creation, creation will destroy us, end quote. On June 20th, Colorado's Cache-La Poudre River, a national heritage area, and home to Colorado's only naturally self-sustaining wild trout population, was contaminated by more than 7,500 gallons of crude oil, hazardous liquid waste, produced water, and other fracking industry chemicals after a well pad was engulfed by floodwaters from unusually heavy snowmelt. Though more than 100 feet away from the river's normal course, excessive runoff wiped out a protective berm at the Noble Energy well site, State 7636. Damaged crude oil tanks and broke key valves on what industry terms a produced water tank, causing the chemicals to drain into the river. While the crude oil and other liquid wastes were releasing, the oil tanks began to float, quickly becoming lifted by the buoyant liquids accumulating under the tanks and unhinging them from their moorings. The tanks then spilled even more crude oil and other toxins into the river. The state-mandated anchors fastened to the tanks to prevent them from moving or spilling completely failed. Worse, because of inadequate oversight, it is unknown how long State 736 was draining into the Poudre before inspectors became aware of the situation. And in a precedent-setting case decided today by the New York Court of Appeals, local communities have triumphed over the fracking industry. The court ruled that the towns of Dryden and Middlefield can use local zoning laws to ban heavy industry, including oil and gas production within municipal borders. Quote, today the court stood with the people of Dryden and the people of New York to protect the right to self-determination. It is clear that people, not corporations, have the right to decide how their community develops, end quote, said Dryden Deputy Supervisor Jason Leifer. Many other cities and towns in New York have been waiting for today's decision to establish bans or moratoriums of their own. The victory also gives legal authority to more than 170 New York municipalities that have passed measures against fracking in their communities. This decision will also serve as inspiration for a growing number of localities in Colorado, Ohio, Texas, Pennsylvania, and California that are hoping to stop the controversial drilling practice. Craig?
Thank you, Naturally, and thank you for the news. My first guest tonight is Kim Lovell, and she is the chair of the National Population Committee for the Sierra Club. And as you might guess, our topic, for the first topic, is going to be population and sustainability issues. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you so much, Craig.
Let me start by, can you just tell us briefly what the policy is of the National Sierra Club regarding population?
Absolutely. So the Sierra Club, National Sierra Club, has had a population program for about 40 years now, just over 40 years. So we've been working on the issue of population that long. We basically look at the issue from the perspective of healthy people, it makes a healthier planet. So we work to make sure that women and families and communities are healthy, that they have access to voluntary family planning services, comprehensive reproductive health and rights, and also access to education and economic opportunities, knowing that these things will lead to healthier people and healthier families and also smaller families, and that will lead to less pressure on surrounding natural resources and communities and a healthier environment at large. So that's sort of the basis by which we do our work at the Sierra Club. We are a pro-choice organization. The organization is pro-choice and really believes that women should have access to a full range of reproductive health care that is voluntary. And like I said, we've been working on this issue for decades and really feel passionately that we can't really tackle any of the major environmental issues facing the world today without also looking at population.
Okay, and when you say we can't tackle those other problems, what is the impact that you see that the growing population has on various sustainability issues, whether it be food supply or global warming and those various issues?
Yeah, well, I think there's definitely an impact on a lot of those issues. Unfortunately, the areas in the world where population is growing the fastest are many of the places in the world where we also have the highest number of biodiverse species, what we like to call biodiversity hotspots. So there's sort of this this impact that is double when you have populations growing really rapidly in places in the world where resources are already scarce and where biodiversity is already being compromised. So a lot of these are countries in the developing world where access to family planning is low, women don't have a lot of access to education or economic opportunities, large families are part of the religious or cultural tradition, and this is compounded on already compromised. So if we help slow population growth through voluntary family planning, this decreases pressure on natural resources locally, on water, on food. You know, food security is a big issue right now.
Okay. Kim, we're having a little problem hearing you.
Okay, I can move closer to the window here. Is this better?
Yes, All right. In terms of some of those issues, like with global warming, is there a way that we can conceivably cut CO2 emissions without tackling the population problem first?
Well, the belief of the Sierra Club is that in order to cut carbon emissions and to really lower the impact that human beings have on the planet, that we absolutely have to address population. And there was a really great study that was done by Brian O'Neill a couple of years ago looking at what the impact of slowing population growth would actually be on carbon emissions. And one of the things the study found was that slowing population growth would result in 16 to 29% of the emissions reductions needed by 2050 to slow dangerous climate change. So basically a lot of the other solutions that we look at when we think about curbing carbon emissions and slowing climate change, things like, you know, increasing clean energy usage, shutting down coal-fired power plants, having more fuel-efficient cars, things like that. Actually, slowing population growth would have a similar, if not greater, effect on carbon emissions to some of those other solutions, and is arguably a lot cheaper and easier to implement than some of those as well. There's a lot more political will to make this happen, and it's more affordable for countries. So we really do believe that slowing population growth is absolutely essential in curbing carbon emissions and in slowing climate change.
Okay, and when we're talking about some of the third world countries where population is a major issue, and we talked about, you mentioned the access to health care and women's issues, but we're dealing with cultural differences between the different societies. So when you're working with communities in these other countries, how do you tackle or overcome the cultural differences?
Yes, that's absolutely a huge issue. And I can give an example. Our program took some activists to India a couple of years ago, back in 2009. We were visiting with a woman in a small village just outside of Delhi and talking to the woman about her family. She was very young. She was about 19 or 20 years old. And she had two children. They were both girls. And we asked her if she planned on having any more children. And she said to us, well, of course I plan on having more children. I'm going to keep having children until I have a boy. Because in India, in her community, female children married off into their husband's family. And male children were the ones that stayed at home or that when they went off and worked, they sent money back to their own family and took care of their parents in old age. So until this woman had enough children or had children enough to have a boy, she wasn't going to have any security for her family as she and her husband grew older. So this is an example of where empowering women, educating women and girls, and really changing the sort of dynamics of how women are valued in culture and society would have a huge impact. Because if her female children could get an education, could go to high school or could go to college, and didn't necessarily have to marry off into another family but could support their own family, that would really change the dynamics of that culture and that community, but it would also result in a smaller family. There's also a lot of cases looking at religion where a lot of religious groups are now starting to work with women on child spacing. If you look at birth spacing, that's something that a lot of religious communities support because it's healthier for the child and for the mother if the mother puts space in between her kids. If she's able to do that, that eventually results in a smaller family because the woman's not having children one on top of another, which, as I mentioned, is bad for the health of the child and of the mother. So there are a lot of really innovative ways and creative things happening to really look at why, from a cultural and religious standpoint, people are having large families and kind of tackle some of those belief systems to make sure that women can have the family size that they want.
Now, one issue relating to that would be, of course, birth control and having contraceptives available to people and to women that choose to use them. What are some of the obstacles involved in getting birth control available and to the people in those countries?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And also, when I ask that, too, I'm thinking, too, is how do we get them to do it when we're having a hard time getting people in our country to do it, and we just have that, you know, Hobby Lobby decision saying the employers don't have to provide, or private employers don't have to provide health insurance for it. So when we're going backwards in our country, how do we get other countries to go forward?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that there are a couple of barriers to access to contraceptives that I'd mentioned. One of the biggest ones is finances, is actually having the money to provide these services to women. And I think that's something where the United States can actually play a really integral role and actually have in the past been one of the number one funders of voluntary family planning services around the country. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, is a huge funder of international family planning programs, currently giving over $600 million a year to other countries to provide these services. But, you know, that's not enough. And every single year, since President Obama has been in office, his proposal for the amount of money to go towards international family planning programs has been cut by Congress to a lower level because a lot of folks in Congress don't want to be giving that money internationally, and therefore we're not really doing as much as we could. Of course, there are many other countries giving money to these programs, but there's always more needed. Another barrier to access to contraceptives is location. And that really plays into this environmental piece, because a lot of the places in the world where population is growing really quickly, and where also we mentioned where these biodiversity hotspots are located, are relatively remote places in the world. They're places in coastal areas, on islands, deep in rainforests, places where they're not close to major metropolitan areas where health clinics are typically located. There's a really great development model called Population Health Environment, or PHE, that's working to get access to contraceptives to women in remote areas, in coastal areas, in island nations, deep within rainforests, to really help sort of mitigate that challenge by making sure that women in remote places that don't have a family planning clinic 3 blocks away or a bus ride away are able to get access to these services. So physical access in terms of location and monetary access, I think, are two of the biggest hurdles.
Okay. Now, I had done a program presentation on population to the local Sierra Club group earlier, in June. Mm-hmm. And one of the part of the presentation dealt with the seven wedges. Can you explain what the seven wedges refer to and what they are?
Oh, absolutely. So that sort of goes back to what I was mentioning earlier about the impact of slowing population growth on carbon emissions. And so there was a study done by a group of researchers called Sokolo and Pakala that produced what they call the stabilization wedge graph. And so what this graph really showed was it plotted the path of carbon emissions that human beings were currently emitting. So how many emissions we are emitting right now at this point in time, and what that path would look like if we did absolutely nothing to curb carbon emissions. We don't curb them in any way. We keep doing everything we're doing now, no solution. Now, it plotted the space between that line, that path of emissions, and what would happen if we did absolutely everything in our power. That would be the x-axis. So if we did everything in our power to curb carbon emissions and we had 0% emissions, what that path would look like, and then the path of where we're headed now, the difference between those two paths was separated into seven different wedges or solutions to curbing carbon emissions. It would bring us down from where we're headed today to where we could be if we were emitting zero as human beings. Those seven wedges represented solutions to curbing carbon emissions like, as I mentioned before, shutting down coal-fired power plants, using wind, solar, and geothermal energy instead of coal energy or energy from natural gas, increasing the fuel efficiency of cars. Each one of these things represented one wedge in this stabilization wedge graph that would bring down emissions by 1 billion tons of carbon per year. Brian O'Neill, the researcher I mentioned previously, was the one that looked at this Sokolo and Pakala stabilization wedge graph, and through his research discovered that slowing population growth would be equal to one of those wedges. So it would be equal to a wedge, it would be equal to a solution to curbing carbon emissions that would result in 1 billion tons of carbon per year being saved. So that was a really revolutionary sort of study demonstrating that while all of these other environmental solutions that we see and deem really important that a lot of environmental groups are working on are very essential to solving this problem, population growth and slowing population growth plays a huge role as well.
Okay, and you mentioned the education factor before. Are there some statistics, correlations that show the differences in the birth rates in countries with higher education of women versus countries where women are less educated?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of studies that have shown an inverse relationship between the number of years of schooling that a woman has and the size of her family. So if you look at a graph and you chart the fertility rate in various countries versus the literacy rate in various countries, as the literacy rate of women goes up and up and up, fertility rate goes down and down and down. So if you look, for example, in a lot of countries in the Middle East where women are very poorly educated currently, where women, the literacy rate for females is very low and the fertility rate, the family size, is very high. However, if you look at countries that have made a lot of revolutionary actions in the realm of education for women, like Thailand, for example, as literacy rates in Thailand for women increase, and they increase exponentially, family size decrease exponentially. And so now you're looking at a situation in Thailand where over 90% of women have an education, have more than an elementary school education, and the fertility rate is hovering around 2 to 3 children per woman. So it's a really well-studied correlation between education and family size that has been proven that when women are educated and women have the ability to continue their schooling, they tend to have smaller and healthier families.
How do we know how much of that is actually attributable to the education versus cultural? Because you mentioned the Middle East, and you have a large Islamic population there. So how do we separate, sort through whether the high fertility rates there are due more to the lack of education and more to the religious differences?
Mm-hmm. Well, the studies that show the correlation between family size and educational level run worldwide. There have been studies that have shown this correlation in religious countries. There have been studies that have shown this correlation in countries where religion doesn't really play a major factor in family size or in sort of the cultural beliefs around them. In each state, there's actually a correlation between education and teen pregnancy rates here in the United States, as well as family size. And it's been shown that...
Kim, I think we lost you there. We're not hearing you right now.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this better?
Yes.
Uh-huh. I was saying that even in the United States, where obviously the religious component plays a role, but not as large of a role as it does in many other countries, there's also a correlation between levels of education and family size here in the United States. And it's been shown that women who have a lower level of education actually have a higher teen pregnancy rate as well. So the correlation really applies across the board in countries where religion does play a major role and in those where it does not.
Okay. Let me ask you one thing that I'm wondering about. Back in the, 60s or 70s, there was a book called Limits to Growth, and then Paul Ehrlich later wrote The Population Bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And the authors of both of those books had predictions that were really quite dire in terms of what was going to happen. Now, some of it, we've gone somewhat toward some of it, but a lot of the predictions did not turn out to be accurate. Things that, because of advances in technology or advances in food production, some of those predictions did not turn out to be accurate. So what does modern science say about that, and how have they modified what they're predicting now?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're absolutely right. Some of those predictions really did not come to fruition in terms of the sort of level and gravity of the exponential growth that was predicted. A lot of that has to do with the Green Revolution and as you mentioned, advances in food and development and food security. There are a lot of other factors that related as well. Today, the United Nations does a series of predictions about the world population and what it will look like in the coming years. The most recent United Nations predictions that we're looking at, future population predictions, have a low, a medium, and a high variant prediction in terms of what the population will look like by, for example, 2050. The medium level prediction is around 9.6 billion. That's sort of the mid-range of what the UN thinks the world is headed towards in the next 40 or so years. The higher level of prediction, the higher variant prediction, is around 11 billion people. So there's really a range. It's difficult to say exactly where we are headed, but we are headed towards growth. And another thing that the United Nations predictions have shown is that growth in the developed world and in wealthier developed countries has really slowed down significantly. I think right now we're at about 1.8 billion people in the developed world, and we're headed towards about 1.9 billion people by 2050. As most people have heard, there are several developed countries that are actually having negative population growth at this point, and that are not growing at all. However, if you look in developing countries, population growth rates are really high. As I mentioned before, these are places where women often don't have as much access to voluntary family planning, education, economic opportunity, et cetera. So in these countries that are already really strapped for resources in many cases and are going to have a lot of trouble dealing with climate change and food security and economic opportunity in the future, these are places where the population is growing really rapidly, and the UN predicts will double or triple or even quadruple in the next 40 to 50 years. So while the predictions that you mentioned in the 60s and 70s and the time of the population bomb were not as drastic as they were predicted to be, we are still growing as a planet, and so it's still extremely important to provide that access to voluntary family planning to help curb that growth.
Okay, and another issue I know that affects population, I think in the United States, most of our growth has been due to immigration. Is that correct?
I don't have statistics on that off the top of my head.
All right. And coming up, I know we have what's called World Population Day. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what the date is for that?
Absolutely. So July 11th, which is this Friday, is World Population Day. This is a worldwide day that's sort of meant to draw attention to this issue and really highlight population dynamics and the way that those issues are being addressed around the world. There's a lot of reproductive health, family planning, environmental, and population organizations that are working to highlight this day through a series of events and blogs, Twitter chats, a lot of things on social media. So there's a lot of different ways to get involved if folks are interested in kind of learning more about population issues on World Population Day this Friday. One of the things that's happening that I would like to invite all folks to join is the Sierra Club is working with an organization called Population Connection to host a Google Hangout that is open for anybody to join. We're hosting it at 2 o'clock p.m. on Friday, this Friday, July 11th. And we're going to have several guest speakers on the Hangout just talking about how they're addressing the issue of population in their respective organizations through a lens of voluntary family planning. We're going to have a program director from Madagascar talking about some of the work that's happening on the ground there, as well as some other partners talking about some more national, international level policy changes that are working to address this issue. So I would love to invite folks to join. They can check out and find a link to the Hangout on our website, which is gearclub.org/population. That's just one of the many activities happening on that day to really highlight and draw attention to this issue.
Okay. And the last issue that I want to address quickly would be one of the things that impacts growth would be the fact that we have food supply, technological advances, and then medical advances. People, you know, 100 years ago, people were living to maybe age 40 or 50, and now they're living to their 70s and 80s. How do we balance that and still curb population growth?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, yes, people are living longer in almost every country in the world, which we think, you know, is a good thing, something that contributes to quality of life and is something that we should continue to work for and towards through advances in medical care and other health care. You know, the balance is really the solutions that I've talked about throughout the course of the interview. I mean, it's basically we need to make sure that as people are living longer and having longer, healthier lives, that women really have access to the tools and the resources and the opportunities to have a smaller and healthier family. And that as that continues, as the trajectory that we're on right now, where women are getting more educated, are having more economic choices and chances in life, and are also having the family size that they want because of access to these services, that will help solve the problem from the other end.
Okay, and I believe we're out of time for this segment. We've been talking to Kim Lovell, the chair of the National Committee on Population for the Sierra Club. And thank you, Kim, for joining us. We are going to have a quick break, and then when we come back, we will be talking to Dr. Ricky Ott regarding oil spills and impacts of that.
Thank you for having me,
Craig. This Tuesday on Radioactive Magazine, Streetcars in Transit and the Hobby Lobby Court Decision. Janet Rogers of the Transit Action Network interviews a Kansas City councilman and the KCATA's Director of System Development on the issues and next steps involved in the development of streetcar transit. Mike Deere, the Kansas City chapter of Move to Amend, provides a commentary on the recent Supreme Court Hobby Lobby decision. That's this Tuesday evening at 6 o'clock on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Wednesday was an historic day.
It was?
Hey, this is your old pal Mike Murphy. You know, I was born on Wednesday, and I'm here to tell you that this Wednesday's child is full of whoa. So join me each and every Wednesday morning until 8 a.m. for music from around the world and around the block. Your Wednesday morning buzz, going 10 years strong. The wonder of it all, baby.
On Wednesday, all the malls across America connect.
After the harvest needs volunteers to help pick corn in Wellsville, Kansas, from July 7th to August 5th. The corn will then be distributed to local food pantries and harvesters. If you're interested in helping, call Corrine Page at 816-853-4460. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Okay, welcome back. Our second guest today is Ricky Ott. Dr. Ott is a marine toxicologist. She's an activist from Alaska, and her specialty is dealing with toxicity issues relating to oil spills. And welcome, Ricky.
Thank you, Craig.
Now, I understand you're doing a tour through the Midwest. What is that about?
Well, okay, we're going to start at the end of this is the grand finale. After 25 years of dealing with Exxon Valdez oil spill and spending a year in the Gulf Coast communities after the BP disaster, and then touring through Michigan communities, and this is all at communities' request, after the tar sand spill there, Arkansas after the tar sand spill there, I started to realize that the government is just not seeing oil spills the same way we all are. We all experience them, we being just the ordinary folks. We tend to believe the industry, we will make you whole. That doesn't work. And citizens don't really have a plan B. So really what this tour is about, it's an extended tour back through the coastal communities, through the upper Midwest, I just did, and now in this region, is along regions that are at risk from oil activities, whether they're pre-spill, pre-event, post-event. Actual spill is one thing, but all these increases in our tar sands production, increases in the stack oil production, is this production is coming much closer to our, it's going through a lot of our small towns, a lot of our big urban areas, a lot of our farm communities, and people have had pipelines going through their neighborhoods for a while, but this stuff is different. So what I'm actually doing is suggesting, I talk about the public health effects I've seen. This is from children on up, babies on up. It's consistent, and it's about what I think people need to know about the downside of oil, the risks of oil, and then how they can prepare themselves. So I'm sharing information, I'm collecting information, and what I'm ultimately trying to do is plan a, it's called ALERT, a locally empowered response team. And it's a hub of trainers, including healthcare professionals, that will produce resources and material available then to these regions of the country that are at risk from oil exposure. So it's how to do, and it's networking with people who are already doing this, if they are, and training and building capacity where they aren't. So it's about environmental monitoring of our air, our water, our soil. It's about public health monitoring. So it's like quasi-epidemiology stuff. But if enough people do it, it's kind of like, the Audubon bird count or something, where you have enough people around the country looking at the same time for the same things. And over the years of doing this, you end up with trend data. And so this is, and then it's about preparing material for the healthcare professionals so they know when they see people about environmental medicine, and they know that the symptoms, cold and flu-like symptoms, the respiratory problems, the central nervous system problems, dizziness, headache, nausea, these sort of common symptoms that go on and on and on maybe aren't from a common causation. Maybe there's something more like chemical illness. If you're around tar sand spill or fracking in your backyard or just an ordinary conventional oil spill, it's a lot of the same symptoms. And the doctors in my year in the Gulf, I realized that the medical community wasn't really prepared to deal with public health the way the medical doctors were trying to deal with occupational health. So people, ordinary folks, are experiencing the same symptoms that a lot of the occupational workers get, and then these turn into illnesses if they're not properly diagnosed and treated. So it's sort of a heads up. It's like alert. We need to be prepared for what is coming through our backyard and sort of balance the information that we've been hearing, and if with the human health risk component. And I think that's been left out of a lot of the rhetoric about tar sands, fracking, offshore oil, Arctic oil, everything.
What are some of the specific health hazards that have been identified relating to oil? I know you mentioned central nervous system. What are some of the other health effects? And does it affect adults differently than young children?
Okay, great questions. It turns out that this the emerging field of environmental medicine kind of came of age during the Exxon Valdez aftermath, so the 20 years or so after Exxon Valdez, not necessarily tied with Exxon Valdez, but just the human health. The wildlife biology was actually using some of the emerging, more sophisticated medical tools for looking at the whales, the fish, the birds. These things were kind of on a parallel track, and it turns out that the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, the ultra-fine particles, 2.5 microns and smaller, if you see it in the air, it's soot. This has been now well-established in the scientific literature, multiple reviews, that there's pretty much four common sets of symptoms. So it's respiratory issues, and again, you know, you'd think it's like an ordinary cold or flu. You go and you take a lot of Tylenol. The pharmacies usually sell out on some of these more common cold treatment drugs. The central nervous system problem. So it's beyond what I mentioned, the headaches, and I'm not just talking light headaches. I'm talking really heavy headaches, migraine-type headaches. But blurry vision, tingling appendages, vertigo kind of vestibular issues, and nausea. So, again, people, it's nothing that tends to, a lot of people have had all these symptoms in some fashion or other, and so it's nothing that sends you to the emergency room. It sends usually people to the pharmacies to try to self-medicate. The third one is skin issues, like rashes, but like really bad rashes, like more like lesions. And then the fourth one is blood issues. So bleeding from various orifices and heavy bleeding, like kids waking up in the morning and their pillows are covered in blood. Then there's a whole host of other issues, but those are the main ones. And it affects, like you mentioned, there's vulnerable parts of our population, vulnerable sectors. Those tend to include the occupational workers if they're not protected, but then children, because they're smaller and they're breathing faster. So they're exposed to the same contaminants if your family's out on the beach, for example, or if your family's in your home while you're, and there's fracking going on, or the schools in Kalamazoo and Mayflower, the school kids were throwing up and vomiting. Because these kids are breathing, they're getting basically an adult dose of poison. So the same amount may or may not trigger issues in an adult, but you more likely see it in the kids. Elderly, because they tend to be already, their bodies are kind of full of toxic chemicals after living a life in our environment, food, air, water, soil, and it could be just a straw that sort of breaks the camel's back and suddenly they're symptomatic. It's also pregnant women, because their bodies are already taxed, they're producing a new life, and their bodies are stressed in that regard, and then suddenly they have to deal with a toxic chemical. African Americans, particularly with oil exposure, because of a predisposition to blood disorders and cardiovascular disorders. And finally, people, of course, with pre-existing illnesses or with chronic symptoms also tend not to be so healthy going in, so one more thing can kind of break them.
Okay, and you mentioned tar sands. Now, these symptoms and these health issues, are they worse with the tar sands oil, or is it about equal to the other types of oil?
That's another good question. Thank you. It's worse. And it's worse because the tar sands oil, it's concentrated in these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. And let me explain these complex hydrocarbons. The laws that were passed in the 1970s, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, U.S. Safe Drinking Water Act, I mean, Occupational Safety and Health Act, a lot of these were geared to the science at the time. So scientists looking at, quote, crude oil figured, oh, well, the parts of it that are going to be toxic to people and toxic to the environment are the fractions that evaporate quickly into the air or dissolve quickly into the water. Those are the volatile organic compounds, also known as water-soluble fraction. That's the stuff now when you go to a gas station and pump gas, the gas hoses are all shielded, so you might be old enough to recall that kind of sweet, sticky smell that you used to be able to smell before. That was like benzene evaporating into the air and the other volatile organic solvents. Well, benzene is one of the oldest known carcinogens. The VOCs tend to be actors that work on the body in like narcosis kind of effects. Yes, they can cause cancers and other long-term problems, leukemia, if left in the body over a long enough period of time. What we're seeing, what the Exxon Valdez oil spill put on the map for wildlife, it sort of changed the face of science for wildlife, and then a parallel body of research was happening independently on humans. It was kind of like the aha moment for medical researchers and wildlife biologists that, oh, it's this black stuff that stays on the beaches. It's this black stuff that's actually a huge, huge problem. These complex hydrocarbons actually cross our skin, cross our lung membranes, get into the cells of our body. This is a whole different mechanism now. And they proceed to jam cell function because they're very similar in structure to a lot of our own complex hydrocarbons that our body makes. So, for example, these PAHs, these ultrafine particles, are endocrine disruptors. They disrupt reproduction. I mean, it just jams cell function, jams production of respiratory enzymes that are responsible for kind of grabbing the oxygen out of the air that you breathe and carrying it through your blood. Stunts growth, stunts behavior and developmental problems, and not just in the organism that's exposed, but in the offspring, in the offspring's offspring. I mean, it can go like that. And so what the scientists realized before the BP disaster even was that these PAHs are actually a really bad actor, and none of the laws were changed to accommodate this new science. And now we have tar sands oil, which is concentrated in these heavy, heavy oil molecules. But there's one other thing with tar sands oil, and I don't want to skip the frack oil. The frack oil is concentrated in the lighter hydrocarbons, more towards the volatile organic carbon end. And, but in addition, the conventional crude, okay, so I'm going to talk to another problem, because it's not just tar sands that, for example, that's coming down these pipelines. In order to get the tar sand liquid enough to flow, it's mixed with, as you probably know, diluents. Well, diluents are petroleum distillates towards the lighter end, the lighter molecules, again, towards the VOC end. And the diluents are very similar to the dispersants that were used in the Gulf for basically dissolving the oil off the surface and emulsifying it into the water column. And the fracking fluid also contains a lot of these petroleum distillates. These are all produced by a naphtha cracking process, and they all act the same. In effect, they either dissolve the oil that's on the surface and sink it. They thin the oil, like if it's tar sands for transportation. They extract the oil out of the rocks, if it's shale oil. So these industrial-strength solvents, if you were, are actually toxic in and of themselves, and they target the same organs of the body as the as oil itself. So now you've got like this double whammy. So tar sands being a mix of heavy oil and the lighter oil, you've actually got kind of the worst of both. It's already like what happened in the Gulf after dispersants were sprayed. You've got this mixture of petrochemicals that's actually worse than the oil alone to human health.
Okay, and then now when the spills in the ocean as opposed to on land, then we're dealing more with absorption through the food chain, is that correct? Whereas the land spills would be more with in emissions and inhaling these chemicals?
I think that there's a couple things going on. I think when you think inland, there's also rivers and wetlands and marshes and aquifers. So there's that issue, plus on land. So it's a combination. Of course, both of those spills, well, actually, all, I'm thinking of Montana, I'm thinking of Michigan, I'm thinking of Arkansas. All those ended up in waterways at one point. However, the your question about what's the route of exposure, I think it's still air, because there are components that get into the air no matter what. And then you've also got, and the reason I say that is because, for example, homes in Arkansas, along the street that was, where the oil ran straight down that street, those homes have actually been bought out, in part because the tar sands, the volatile components of it, absorb onto the furniture, onto the clothes, onto the carpets, onto the stuff in your home, and it makes the home toxic, basically. So that is definitely one route of exposure. And then the other is, I don't think this has been figured out yet, the soil and the land contamination, and actually how you clean this stuff up. So I wouldn't discount the water and the air route.
Okay. And I believe this is the 25th anniversary for the Valdez spill. Is that correct?
We call it the memorial, the 25th memorial of the Exxon Valdez. Yep.
Okay. And is there still ongoing cleanup efforts that are going on, or do they believe that everything has returned to normal?
We're kind of low on both. So there are no ongoing, we don't really call them cleanup efforts because we realize that once oil gets spilled, it's really more like a spill response, not a cleanup in the thinking that when people hear the word cleanup, they think the oil is going to be contained and removed and out of wherever it's spilled. And that's just not what happens. So the spill response, there are still pits of oil. It is slowly, very slowly degrading over time. It is still impacting a lot the young, in particular the young animals, so the eggs, the embryos that come ashore that are in the nursery bays. The herring have, the sound itself, I think there are 9 out of 32 species that were studied, okay, that's the key thing, that are listed as fully recovered. The rest are not. Herring have not even been listed as beginning to recover. And that's a huge problem because there was a quite robust and thriving herring fishery that supported part of the town's economy with tax revenues and but also income to the fishermen. And that's just, I mean, it hasn't been fished. It just hasn't been fished. And guys that had the limited entry permits are basically sitting on permits that were, up to $300,000. And they owed annual payments on those, much like a house payment. They were unable to fish their permits. They were unable to pay those loans. And it's actually the debt that really disrupted the culture. A lot. What I've discovered when I was pushed back on the 25th memorial, again, for everybody, was that particularly in Prince William Sound, there's a very young generation of fishermen that have brought in. It's on average much younger than anywhere else because the guys, older guys that were fishing at the time were kind of put out of business one way or the other over time. And their permits, they sold them, and these young guys could afford them. And so it's just an interesting sort of dynamic. The pink salmon did recover. The fishermen figured out while we were waiting for our herring and pink salmon, because we had no idea when the runs collapsed, when they would recover. We niche marketed our Copper River salmon, so we got paid more money for the unoiled fish, fisheries, and we kind of pulled ourselves back up again. But it's an amazing thing with one of these disasters because every memorial, another year rolls around, and it's particularly bad when the media rolls back in town like it did for the 5th, the 10th, the 20th, and now the 25th. It just brings up all this trauma again. And there was, we were a, Cordova was a case study in disaster trauma.
Okay, Doctor, we are out of time.
All right.
I want to thank you for joining us. We've been talking to Dr. Ricky Ott. She's a marine toxicologist specializing in oil spills and the impacts. Dr. Ott will be here in Kansas City on Sunday, July 13th, this next Sunday. She will be speaking at 1:30 p.m. on that day at the Shawnee Mission Unitarian Church at 9400 Flum in Lenexa. And that is open to the public. Everybody is invited. So if you want to learn more about these issues, please join Ricky for that speech. Thank you for joining us. Thank you.
And this is Naturally. I have your events. There are 2 events this Saturday. The first I'd like to tell you about is from 8 a.m. to 11:30. It's an electronics recycling event where all electronic items with a battery or a cord are accepted. All items are free except your tube TVs. There will be a small fee to recycle those, and they're asking for you to call to make an appointment to help with traffic flow. The number is 913-715-6907, or you could log on to jocogov.org and look under their events. The Sierra Club in Kansas will be hosting a tour of the Heartland Harvest Garden. That starts at 10 a.m. at the Powell Gardens. It's set on 12 acres. The Heartland Harvest Garden is the nation's largest, quote, edible landscape, a delicious place designed to satisfy all of your senses. As you explore each of the gardens within, you'll learn about the journey of food from seed to plate. And as mentioned on one of the spots we played, after the harvest, an organization needs your help beginning today and over the next 5 weeks to August 5th to pick 28 acres of sweet corn in three different fields. There are 20 acres in Wellsville, Kansas, 3 acres in Bucyrus, Kansas, and 5 acres in Nevada, Missouri. All of this corn is being picked, is being donated by the farmers to After the Harvest and will be the first pick in these fields. They are in need of scout groups, church groups, neighborhood groups, or any old group of people at all who are interested in getting fresh food to people in need. You can find them on their Facebook page, After the Harvest KC, or you can call 816-854-4460 to see how you can help. And that's all for Eco Radio.
I'm under the radar and I'm powered by me.